From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Rebecca Solnit can really write, but she also has a few other tools in her artistic repertoire. She's a mapmaker. Her new book is called Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. But this is not an atlas of the AAA variety. It's a series of maps and essays that plot a very personal vision of what San Francisco and the Bay Area looks and feels like. It maps where landmark civil rights events took place, where Native tribes once lived, where Sly Stone once performed, and what South of Market looked like before it was South of Market. A conversation with Rebecca Solnit about mapping San Francisco, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Maps are about orientation. You look at them to find where you are and where you want to go. But maps can also describe more than the best route from here to there. They place you, especially if it's a place that's yours. Rebecca Solnit's new book is called Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. But this is not your usual roadmap. Instead, it charts a much more personal vision of what Solnit's San Francisco is all about. The maps we get most of the time show conventional reality, Solnit writes. Freeways and not bird migration routes. Shopping highlights, not subjective memories. Solnit's Atlas charts the pattern of migration and the pattern of memory. It's about why it matters to map your own city and plot the place you call home. And Rebecca Solnit joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell me first where this idea came from. You're a very prolific writer. You've published a lot of books. Where did the idea of coming up with an atlas come from?
You know, I could dig back various distances. One is that I've always loved maps since I was a little kid reading, you know, books like Lord of the Rings with maps in them. Two is that there's ways of describing San Francisco that maps succeed at more dramatically than written descriptions, although I'm a writer. So I'd always wanted to, for a long time, I'd wanted to do these series of maps. And then the next phase is that the curator Frank Smigal at SF MoMA asked me to propose a project for the museum's 75th anniversary. I proposed this. To my amazement, the museum said yes. And then I said, hold that thought, ran across the bay to UC Press and said, well, we're going to do a series of broadsides with them, but what I really want to do is an actual atlas, a book of maps. And to my continuing amazement, they said yes too, and so began this monster project.
And we should mention that those maps, seven of the maps that appear in the book are available at SF MoMA?
Well, they're actually available at independent bookstores, including Moe's, City Lights, and the Green Arcade on Market Street. They're coming out one a month as free broadsides, a few thousand each month. Get them while you can, and we have 1 month to go. The last and most One of the most beautiful maps, called Lost World, will be out in a week and a half.
What was it that is missing from most maps that you so wanted to plot and chart?
Really, two things are missing. It's as though there was a fork in the road, to use a map metaphor, and maps, you know, half of what I always loved about maps went down one side and lost a lot. The other went down the other side. We now have a lot of practical maps online that just are very useful and extremely ugly, or at least deeply inaesthetic. So the kind of visual pleasure and splendor of the old maps, where you had mermaids and the north wind personified blowing across the map, or just beautiful colors and things, disappeared. So, and then we have a lot of people making kind of decorative maps, and a lot of artists riffing on maps, but that you can't use them to get from here to there. So the beautiful became useless, the useful became inesthetic. I wanted to make beautiful, radical, relevant, topical maps.
And on the relevance factor in particular, relevant to you, right? I mean, part of what you're crafting in this book is Rebecca Solnit's Atlas of San Francisco. And the idea is that we all ought to sort of give some thought in part to what each of our maps of this city looks like.
Well, it's relevant to me in that it's driven by my interest, but I hope that it's sort of public-spirited. This is not all about me and my subjective experience. And there's a lot of histories from before I was born. There's a lot of subjects relating to other ethnicities. There's a lot of, you know, it obviously starts from my perspective, but it's an attempt to make multiple descriptions that are relevant to many different populations and, you know, queer San Francisco and the African-American Bay Area relation to musical and labor histories, the world that was scraped away before I moved to San Francisco to create Yerba Buena Center south of Market, you know, and things like that. So it's really, I hope a little bit more public-minded than that. But of course, it's a very finite atlas of an infinite city, and a big part of its spirit comes from that wonderful tagline of Scoop Nisker on another radio station, KTAM, in the 70s. If you don't like the news, go out and make your own. And people will be very nitpicky about this atlas because it doesn't show their thing.
Right.
But I really want it to be a starting point for people to think about the fact that they already contain multitudes of maps, that they already have a lot of ideas and associations, and that we have these deeply cartographic memories, and this is an invitation to get in touch with your own as well as mine.
Yeah, I think when I'm asking this question, it's not so much to suggest that this is just Rebecca Solnit, San Francisco, or that it is self-interested in some way, so much as to suggest that we each have our own kind of map
Absolutely.
Of the city,
yeah.
And it's worth thinking about what it is that we construct that are landmarks for each of us.
That's one of the things that I think makes a city infinite is that, you know, therapists say no two people live in the same family, no two people live in the same city either, that, you know, depending on whether a lot of people or few people look like you, whether you're a janitor at night in the high rises or a stockbroker by day, whether you live in the Excelsior or the Marina, you live in a very different San Francisco. There are infinite San Franciscos. And I wanted to suggest some of that, you know, and from many different perspectives. So it's really kind of about stepping out of myself and finding those perspectives and encouraging people to move from there to understand, you know, the kind of inexhaustibility of a city. And my working definition for this project is that a city is many worlds in one place.
And that it continues to change. I mean, part of the point you also make is that it is a map is really never set. Even if you're mapping your backyard, you know, before you know it, plants grow, leaves fall off, something changes.
Yeah, we have a map that includes both the lost industrial world of San Francisco as it existed in 1960 when we were a big port manufacturing and food manufacturing town, not just an eating town. And, you know, it also maps one of the great relics, or maybe not so great relics, the 6 a.m. bars. There were 21 when Stella Lockman went to research them. I'm not sure there are still 21, a year and a half since we did that research. So maps instantly become outdated, but then they become history, which is still relevant.
Let's talk about some of the chapters and maps that are in the book. You begin with laying out for us all of the original Native American Indian names of different villages that populated this region. And part of what's striking about it is just the number of them. I think I counted a dozen just on the peninsula alone. Why start there?
You know, that's the original and deeply absent history, except for a few place names like Olima and Petaluma that most of us are familiar with. You know, it's really the human beginnings of this moment. It's also really startling. I was shown a version of some of this map by Chuck Striplin, a Ohlone guy, and it, to use a very 70s phrase, kind of blew my mind. You know, I've been in the Bay Area pretty much my whole life. I know it really well. I know a fair amount about it. And suddenly I was seeing all the familiar landforms labeled with completely unfamiliar names. It said, this place is, and to me that said, this is not where, you are not where you think you are. This is also someplace else. This was another world entirely. So I think that maps orient you, but they also disorient you when they tell you something you don't know that you think, you know. One of the first things I did for this project is I took out just a AAA map of San Francisco and I looked at all the terra incognita of the city and realized about half of the city I'd never been to, even though I know it better. You know, it's in several of my books. I've been here 30 years. I walk a lot. I know it pretty well. So that felt like the right place to begin, both to pay respects in the spirit of a Native artist who what is his name? Edgar Heap of Birds, who puts up signs thanking the people whose homeland they're on whenever he does a project somewhere. You know, thank you, Ohlone and Miwok people. We know we're on your land, and this is what it looked like before 1769.
And what do you hope people take from that in terms of reorientation?
I think to recognize that this was a densely inhabited and culturally diverse area even before other cultures started to arrive, that I'm old enough, I grew up when we were told, I don't know if you grew up in California, but that Native Californians were diggers, which is a very derogatory term that implied, that was based on the idea they just dug up things, grubs with sticks, and that's what they lived on. They basically had no culture and they disappeared. We now recognize that we're the second richest linguistic area in the world after Papua New Guinea, California, in terms of density and diversity, that every language had a worldview and a mythology, and that you even had these sort of sub-language groups. We don't just talk about the Ohlone or the Costanoan. You know, Lisa Conrad's fantastic research shows us that actually breaks down into dozens of tribelets or, you know, subgroups. So I wanted people just to have a sense that this place was complex and rich before, you know, the Spaniards showed up, and that some of that is still present and to remember. And I believe that I have a historical imagination. I believe that to know where you are now, you have to know what happened before. And this is really valuable information. This is actually the first time this data has been published. A wonderful ethnogeographer, Randy Milliken's been doing the research and made it available to us. Lisa Conrad organized it for the map. Ben Peace, our cartographer, put it on the map. Leah Chandra, our designer, made it beautiful. And here you have it for the first time, this kind of up-to-date, intensely researched picture of what was and is here.
One of the mini maps that appear in Infinite City, a San Francisco atlas by Rebecca Solnit. One of the other early maps in the book is also about remembering something that is sometimes not fully understood. And that's the chapter that's titled Green Women, and that plots out the green space that's still here in the Bay Area and the people who are responsible for that.
Yeah, that was another wonderful map project. We actually borrowed that map from Richard Walker's great book, The Country and the City, His Environmental History of the Bay Area, drawn by the cartographer Derek Jensen, and adapted it. Hugh Dandre did the ornamental border based on research that Dick and I did with some help from others. To really commemorate, you know, we put men's names on most things. That's why you have a place with a name like San Francisco after St. Francis, or Fremont after John C. Fremont, or, you know, et cetera. There's a few women saints in the Bay Area, Santa Rosa, Santa Clara. But women often disappear from history. But as Dick's book points out, and his wonderful essay for my book, it was mostly women who did the heavy lifting that protected all this land. Maps often show what has happened, and this is kind of a map of what hasn't happened. These places have not been paved over, bulldozed, destroyed, eliminated, privatized, suburbanized, sprawled upon. And when you look at them, you can actually see them. You can see Mount Diablo Open Space Area. You can see Mount Tamalpais National Park. But what you don't see is who made that possible, who's protecting these places. The ornamental border modeled after 19th century ornamental maps is sort of names and sort of at least metaphorical portraits of these women.
It's a really important point, I think. It's a question that people often ask when they come to the Bay Area, because there's a surprise. Here's this, you know, place where 5+ million people live. And yet, as you note in the book, 3.5 of the 4.5 million acres in the Bay Area are actually open space. And it didn't happen that way by accident. And there were these people, the Committee to Save the Green Foothills in the peninsula, and the Marin Conservation Group, that made that happen. And it was the work of women.
Yeah, and it wasn't only the work of women. My father was actually the chief of advanced planning, who wrote the master plan for Marin during the decade they were fighting the developers over whether Marin would become, you know, this something like Simi Valley or the San Fernando Valley. And, you know, and a lot of people participated. Well, he was on salary for it, but there was these amazing tough women who were volunteers who really kind of, you know, made it possible. And and one of the things that happens, and this is one of the reasons this atlas felt important, this is a region of transients, people who don't live here. It's not like New Orleans, where I've spent a lot of time since Katrina, where people tend to be rooted, to know their history, etc. A lot of people think like, oh, it's just that way, rather than somebody fought to protect this. And one of the reasons people aren't that environmentally optimistic is that most environmental victories I've written about in other places, like my book Hope in the Dark, look like nothing happened. You know, Mount Tamalpais, people will say, well, what's a big deal about that? Nothing happened. And it's like, well, a lot happened so that nothing would happen there. And this kind of reminds you that it's not it's not, these places are places where nothing happened with bulldozers, but that's because a lot happened with legislation and community and organizing and voices and media and et cetera to keep those bulldozers out.
You don't often think, I don't think at least, of maps being something that reveals history, but that's really what these maps do. You write at one point that a map is a ticket to a territory, and this is what that does. It opens up what's there and what's been.
Some of our maps do other things, like phrenological San Francisco, which is the city of San Francisco, as a head in profile with its 19th century phrenological categories by Paul Lafarge, is a fantasia of using a sort of discredited science to very accurately describe San Francisco's psyches and cultures. So, you know, we have other things. But, yeah, and a number of the maps, like the Mission map, is absolutely about the present, the existence of
right.
coexistence of day laborers and inner city kids, many of them Norteño and Sereno gang kids in the Mission, a Mission, I might add, absolutely without the retail you see on most sort of maps of the place, and with the stuff you don't see, the soccer fields and churches and gang territories. But you know, so it's not all looking backwards. And some of it's looking forwards. The first map in the book is this indigenous culture before all these other things happen. The last map is called Once in Future Waters. It's the 19th century waters of San Francisco before it was developed, but it's also the future shoreline if oceans rise a meter and a half. The very tough scientists at the Estuary Institute insisted on choosing a very reasonable and almost conservative number of sea level rise. You know, if we push that up another meter, the shoreline gets a lot more dramatic. But so, you know, we even have a map of the future in there and a bunch of maps of the present.
There's some interesting juxtapositions, and I want to ask you about that within the map, where you purposely layer on top of each other maps that aren't seemingly obvious. Perhaps the most dramatic is a map that's called Death and Beauty that plots out where murders have taken place in the city of San Francisco, and it's juxtaposed with a map of where cypress trees are in the city as a way of sort of putting together both what is horrific and what is beautiful. I just want to read a little bit of this section about the murder part and then ask you about the juxtaposition. What's written here is, here on a map of San Francisco, 99 red dots disperse scattershot on a golden wash of green. Regard each dot as life and be mindful. Know that for each location marked, that's where contact between murder and murderer occurred. That's where life was taken and death delivered. That's where the ambulance, fire trucks, and police cars arrived. Sirens blasting, lights whirling, rushing from elsewhere in the city to attend the victim, dying or already dead. That's where the body was removed. And you go on to place those actual red dots on the map as places of knowing that that's where these murders took place. And you write, they are the red dots in waiting, tens of thousands of them, enough to make the map run red.
I should add that's actually by Summer Brenner, not by me. There's 11 other writers in this book and 12
artists.
Thanks
for noting that. I should have noted that earlier.
That's okay.
That you
just
do
want to
many
give
of the
credit.
Essays, but there are many other fine writers who participate in that. Thanks for the correction. But describe what was going on there and the creation of that. There are all these very striking red dots that show you where murder took place, and then juxtaposed where cypress trees are, this beautiful ancient creation?
Well, there's a general and a specific answer. The general answer is almost half the maps here are about pairings, the pairing of the World War II shipyards that brought the African-American population in with the incredible efflorescence of musical culture in particular that resulted from that in-migration in the map called Shipyards and Sounds, Joshua Jelly Shapiro put together what seems to be a lot of people's favorite map, Monarchs and Queens, which is about queer public space and butterfly species in San Francisco, which is so I juxtaposed a number of things. It's partly efficient use of space. It's partly illustrating my principle that a city is many worlds in one place. To show two worlds, to me, suggests both the way that these things relate and don't relate. Sometimes they're complementary, sometimes they're opposite, or they illuminate each other in some way. And, it gives you a sense that there are many other groups and pairings, and that all maps are arbitrary. To show freeways is arbitrary. You could also map soil types. You could, you know, and I think they're intentionally arbitrary pairings, although I hope with certain kinds of poetic and sometimes political resonances, to give you the sense I was hoping people would get of this sort of infinite city richness and these coexistences.
And why this pairing of red dots and cypress trees?
This map actually came, I was catching a bus downtown to reading the Chronicle. And the Chronicle every January publishes a murder map, a map of all the previous year's murders in San Francisco. And it's really striking. And this is part of why, even though I'm a writer, I will always be a writer, I wanted to do maps as well. If I say there were 99 murders in San Francisco, you'll say, oh, that's too bad. If I show you a map, there's something specific where you, and you imagine it, you feel it in a different way. You see this pattern like buckshot shot into the wall of death. You see that there's a lot more on the east side of town than the west. I was really struck by that, and I thought, okay, we're going to use that. And, you know, we did a lot of this work in 2009, so 2008 was the year to work with. And I was like, what's the opposite of, what do you pair, how do you counterbalance these terrible violent deaths? And of course, there's more than 6,000 deaths in San Francisco. The rest of them are more or less natural deaths, meaning they're by illness and, you know, not by violence. At or not, you know, and I thought death and beauty, and actually first I thought death and birth, and I thought of all the things that have been invented here, television and cinema and Levi's jeans and blah, 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 and that wasn't very interesting. Then I thought death and beauty, and this gives you a little bit of the sense of the process on these maps. I asked a bunch of people, what's the most beautiful thing or place in San Francisco? And the answers I got were very conventional, and I didn't want to suggest that poor people on the east side of town have death and, you know, rich people on the west side of town have scenic beauty. That wasn't at all what I was interested in. And so I was like, okay, I have to figure out what beauty is for myself. And one of the overlooked things in San Francisco is the Monterey cypresses. They're both a very specific tree that only existed in the Monterey Peninsula before they started being planted. They're very well habituated to San Francisco's weather, and they're very strikingly beautiful trees, but I don't think most people pick them out of the crowd of trees. And it felt cypresses are traditionally planted in cemeteries. They have a certain kind of funereal dignity to them. And in the course of mapping with Shizu Segal, one of the cartographers, as many cypresses as we could find in San Francisco, I found that there's actually 700,000 trees in San Francisco and to the 800,000 people. It gives you a sense of these two upright populations living their very different lives. And trees are calm and stable and, you know, tend to not murder each other, etc. And they felt both like memorials and counterbalances. So it was a very intuitive matching, but one that, you know, I still feel good about.
Rebecca Solnit, our guest this hour. Her new book is called Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. We have to take a short break. When we return, we'll open up our phone lines too and have you call in, if you would, and add what you would add to a map of San Francisco. What are the landmarks in your life that are important to orient you and that describe what it is about this city that you love? Or if it's the city across the bay, whether that's Berkeley or Oakland or south on the peninsula or north to Marin, give us a sense of what you think ought to be mapped about the Bay Area. We'll take your calls when we return. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us your map at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Rebecca Solnit is our guest this hour. Her new book is an atlas. It's called Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. But as we've been talking about, a different kind of atlas, an atlas that maps a variety of other things beyond the usual roads and freeways that dominate most of the maps that all of us like. And we do like maps. I mean, part of that, part of what motivated you, I know, and part of this was a love of map. I suspect you're not someone who probably uses a GPS a lot, right?
No, I actually still, I own a lot of atlases and paper maps, and I use a GPS occasionally for when I'm in strange cities like Detroit and New Orleans trying to figure my way out, but mostly not.
Would you read, if you would, Rebecca Solnit, part of your personal description of part of San Francisco that's written in poem form. If you just read part of that, that would be great.
Yeah, this is a map called Who Am I Where? And it's partly bilingual. It's really a dialogue between me and the performance artist Guillermo Gomez Peña about who we are in different places. Because we talk about identity as though to be Chinese is to be Chinese, but to be Chinese in China is very different than to be Chinese in San Francisco, which is very different than to be Chinese in northern Idaho, for example. You know, and to be Guillermo in the Mission District is very different than to be Guillermo in Pacific Heights, and this the same goes for all of us, that who you are is shifting constantly as you move. And I wanted to call attention to that, so Guillermo and I each did one side of the map, kind of describing who we are, often in the same places, and I know you liked this opening on my half. In the Japanese tea garden, I am always 6 years old. In the Richmond district, I am wrapped up in dim sum steam, fog, and the fatigue of the grid. At Ocean Beach, I am all joy and liberty on the edge of the infinite. In the sunset, I am almost Irish enough, but not San Franciscan enough. At Mission Dolores, I'm amazed by the arrival of the Ohlone Hut in all that problematical romantic atmosphere. And that's a reference to something illustrated in this book, which is this amazing Ohlone Hut, speaking of that first map and the sort of persistence of these first peoples in the graveyard of Mission Dolores, which is also part of the movie Vertigo, which that appears on another map. So in the Latino mission, Guillermo's mission, I am La Guerra Neo-Victoriana, his nickname for me. In the Valencia corridor of the mission, I tried to remember what it looked like last week and last century. You know, it goes on in that vein. And although actually Guillermo, I love Guillermo's lines more than mine on the other side of the map. I gave him the east side. He lives a ways east of me in the city. And I just want to read one of his. At the corner of 16th and Cap, I feel like Buddha walking across a garden of new ideas and used syringes.
Hmm. Let's hear what some of our listeners are thinking about mapping San Francisco and what would be on their own maps. Jean in Alameda joins us first. Jean, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. I've been in San Francisco, well, familiar with it since I was 19 years old. My mother brought me up here. I'm from Los Angeles. My family, my parents, they're deceased now, and particularly my father, he loved Los Angeles, but when my mother brought me here when I was 19, and I went and I was in San Francisco, I immediately fell in love with it, and I have been ever since. And I'm in my 50s now, and I moved to Seattle for a couple of years, and I came back to San Francisco in 2006, and I drove down to the marina, and I looked at the Golden Gate Bridge, and I said, "There's nothing like this," and this is why I came home. Hmm. It's a beautiful city, and it always has my heart, and my friends know that. I mean, they're like East Bay people, and I live in the East Bay, but I'm a real San Francisco person at my heart. And thank you for your guest and her. I'm going to buy the book.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks for telling that story. You also reference the Golden Gate, but you tell an interesting story about someone who remembers that same vista before the bridge was built.
Yes, one of the maps that was really fun is called 400 Years and 500 Evictions. It pairs the lives of four centenarians born in and who lived their whole lives in San Francisco with 500 LS Act evictions we got from a map put together by somebody else to suggest not everybody gets to stay in San Francisco for life. But part of what inspired it is one of the centenarians, a wonderful woman named Ad Bond, who's a friend of Patrick at the Green Arcade Bookstore. He took me to visit her. We were drinking the sweet vermouth she likes. I was admiring her view from Russian Hill, where she's been for about 65 years or 70 years. And she said, "Oh, I don't like the Golden Gate Bridge. It ruined the view." And it was one of those shocking moments for me, like looking at Chuck Stripling's map of indigenous sort of tribe and place names, where it's like you don't really think, you know, I know I've seen Ansel Adams' pictures of the Golden Gate before the bridge, and it's magnificent, but I never really thought about hanging out with somebody who remembered what the Golden Gate was like. And that was a reminder. you know, the Golden Gate Bridge looks very different to her because she remembers the gate without it, how big the ships looked coming through the gate, how wide open it was, and how wild. And I just love that comment. The bridge ruined the view.
And, or even remembering that, in fact, Golden Gate is that the bridge is named for the location, not the other way around. Most people don't even realize that the Golden Gate is not actually the bridge itself.
Yeah, it was named by John C. Fremont when it was still part of Mexico, when, you know, California was still Mexican territory. We moved back here when I was 4 years old, and I expected the Golden Gate Bridge to be golden, not red, and I was disappointed at the time, but I've gotten over it.
Casey in San Francisco joins us next. Casey, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. In the spirit of make a culture and DIY culture, how can one teach themselves how to make maps? Is there free software, or do you have any suggestions for those of us who feel or are feeling creative about our environment?
Well, I have to say I employed four or five fantastic cartographers because I don't do that stuff myself, you know. And that's one route to go. But you can make much more informal maps just by taking an existing map and drawing on top of it. But there is something I'm hoping to do as an extension of this project. SFMOMA will probably have a next generation of the project with a show and an online presence next year. And I want to put blank maps of San Francisco and the Bay Area online for people to download and either hand map or do their own online things with them and bring them back to us to make the infinite city a little broader than my very finite atlas of 22 maps. So watch for that next year. One way or another, we'll put some maps out for people to work with.
What does it mean to be a cartographer? How does one learn that?
Well, they teach you there's a cartography classes in the geography department at UC Berkeley, and I think there's probably more technical schools to teach it. A cartographer is literally a map maker, which means having a lot of technical skills. It's mostly done with computers now. You often download existing base maps and add and alter the data according to what you're doing.
Casey, thanks for the call. If anyone else has thoughts about how one could engage in their own personal map making, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. It's also the kind of project you can imagine taking place at the Exploratorium, where people could come and create their own maps. It would be very much in the spirit, I think, of that place.
This may also be the infinite project. My friend Susan Schwarzenberg at the Exploratorium may have some further mapping projects in life for this project at the Exploratorium.
Jesse in San Ramon has a question. Jesse, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a native San Franciscan, born and raised in the Mission District, and I was wondering if any maps tracking the patterns of immigrants living in different neighborhoods has been done. Growing up in the Mission, I was aware of the history of going from Irish and Italian to Mexican to different Latin Americans, but it seems like a really interesting cultural impact on the location.
We address that in different ways. The Mission map itself is a reminder that whatever's happened to the Mission in the last 15 years, it still has huge immigrant Latino and poor Chicano populations that Adriana Camarena mapped for me. We also have a wonderful map called Tribes of San Francisco by Jaime Cortez, modeled after Covarrubias's Great World's Fair map for Treasure Island in 1939. And that shows, in pictures and words, a lot of the different areas, you know, the Irish in the Sunset, the Samoans, and the sort of Excelsior, Bayview, etc. But we didn't really do a lot. We didn't trace the historical change, which would be a complicated thing to do on a map because you have the same place with different layers. But I think the project as a whole, or I hope the project as a whole, gives a sense of these shifting populations. Jaime's map in particular is about the way that these things come and go, that some of these things, you know, he drew so beautifully, a Filipino dandy from the 1930s, a longshoreman, a Rosie the Riveter, a 1970s gay hustler on Polk Street, you know, are evanescent populations that have been replaced by other populations.
Jesse, thanks for the call. You write it at one point, Rebecca Solnit, or one of your essayists writes, I'm not sure, as I recall now, whether it was you or someone else, that a place is a stable location with unstable converging forces. And that's part of what I think Jesse was talking about,
that it's this
constant sort of ebb and flow of different populations.
Yeah, I lived in the same apartment in the Western Addition for 25 years and realized that to see change, you have to be slower than change. And I was constantly meeting people who had just moved into the neighborhood, thought it was a stable neighborhood, and didn't realize that they were part of the change. And it was a black neighborhood when I moved in, and it was a white neighborhood when I moved out. And, you know, that everything is in flux. And some of that we deplore, some of that we're thrilled by. And but one of the things I hope to provide people, particularly because this is – despite some of the wonderful people who just called in who've been here most or all of their lives, most people don't have those baselines to say, this used to be an industrial city, not a white-collar city. This, you know, San Francisco used to be almost 13% African-American, not less than 7%. You know, and that stuff is really important to understand how change continues, to be able to see it in the present as well.
One of that last fact is one that's, again, quite striking. And there is something about a map that makes a sentence that you write much more visual and visceral. And you have a map that's black San Francisco, and it shows where different historic events took place, not only in migration here, but also civil rights moments, fun moments like where the Pointer Sisters once sang or Sly Stone first sang, that sort of thing. But it also has the demographic statistics, and you see that dramatic decline in the black population of San Francisco.
But you also see the dramatic rise, and if you get historically minded, and San Francisco was like, I think, less than 1% African-American before World War II. We had this huge rise of population and then a decline. I think some of the decline is actually because the Bay Area continued to grow and the numbers of African-Americans stayed relatively stable. But it's also about gentrification and people being pushed out.
Another point you make, although it's not really mapped, but I think would be really fascinating to see, is that San Francisco has the lowest number of children of any major city in the United States, about half the national average. If you mapped out where children are in the city of San Francisco, that would be fascinating.
I think we have more dogs than kids here, although the kids are much better housebroken, I have to say. That is present in a way. Jaime Cortez shows a little African-American girl jump roping and a sort of brown kid with a backpack. And I write about that because in the essay that goes with Jaime's map, because he talks about these comings and goings of populations, and one of the things that's really going is kids. This is such an expensive, difficult city for families, and the percentage of kids is in radical decline, which is a very strange thing for a city. You know, adults, human beings are not all adults, and it's another one of the weird forms of segregation we get out here, and you know.
To Sean next in San Francisco. Sean, go ahead. Oh, we lost you, Sean. Call back if you'd like. We'll go next to Francisco. That's well named. Francisco, go ahead.
Yes. Well, first I wanted to thank Rebecca for her work. It's wonderful how you try to make visible what we often so often overlook in all the ghosts that surround us. So I really enjoy your work. And I just wanted to ask you, what public events are you planning that are linked to the publishing of your book?
What a lovely question. Thank you so much. I'll be at City Lights next Thursday with the poet Aaron Shuren, who wrote a fantastic essay for the book. And then we have two more public...
Two events at SFMOA.
Yeah, we have one on... two in conjunction with the last map, Lost World, which is a map that reconstructs exactly what the Yerba Buena area looked like in 1960 when it was still a blue-collar SRO hotel, kind of bar, tavern, pawn shop, corner store, manufacturing kind of neighborhood. So on Thursday the 9th, I'll be in a conversation with the amazing photographer Ira Nowinski, who photographed the destruction of that neighborhood and the lives of the mostly old men who were being forced out. And the last event, which I'm very excited about, will be in the afternoon of Saturday, December 11th. And we're going to kind of go backwards from looking at what Yerba Buena area the area is now, moving back through different moments in history, through moments of its labor history, of its kind of punk rock protest history, with my brother David Solnit, who did amazing stuff there, and the 1980s.
And Carl Nolte will also be part of that, the great San Francisco Chronicle columnist.
No, I have never met him. I'm very excited about that. But we're going to roll the clock backwards until Ruth Askvold from the Asteroid Institute brings us back to when this was all sand dunes and wildlife habitat and there were very few people wandering around.
So that's Saturday, December the 11th at 3 o'clock at SF MoMA. And then the other event that Rebecca mentioned is Thursday, December the 9th, also at the museum. And that's in the evening at 7 o'clock,
on Thursday, December 9th.
And just repeat again, you'll be at City Lights?
City Lights Books at 7 p.m. on Thursday the 2nd.
And back to our calls. And you predicted this, who our next caller will be, Rebecca. Go ahead, Dave.
Yo, hey, Rebecca. Of course I had a call. And I was thinking of a couple of first antecedents of your this particular series of maps. I'm talking about Peter Berg, who back in the day, coming out of the diggers to Planet Drum, began to map out the watershed around the mountain that San Francisco became. And then the second one, of course, is Chris Carlson, Shaping San Francisco, who with Shaping San Francisco, with what he's done, has so many layers of maps of a lot of the same histories and histories and hipsteries you talk about. And I also think of my own maps, which is my own half a century here, which is like North Beach in the 50s, which is a bike messenger also in the 50s, riding around, a bike messenger by day and a beatnik by day and night, and riding around what that working class town that you mentioned that San Francisco was then, with very few or any high rises. And of course, the Fillmore, back before redevelopment, Fillmore Street, a map going down Fillmore Street with places like the Blue Moon and
Let me jump in, Dave. Thank you, Diamond Dave, for the call on the Fillmore, if I might, because you do have a whole map of the Fillmore and yet another example of a place that's undergone remarkable change.
Yeah, it's called Promenading the Boulevard of Gone as the subtitle. It has a wonderful Rorschach blot illustration by Gent Sturgeon, a City Lights longtime staffer, artist, and wonderful longtime friend of mine. And that was a map. The Fillmore's often talked about, or Fillmore Street as an African-American street, but before it was that, there was a Japanese community that was evicted by, you know, incarceration during World War II, which partly made room for this incoming black migration. It was a Jewish neighborhood even earlier in the century, you know, and then a lot of beat history took place around there. And had multiple things mostly gone, multiple cultural flowerings. And you can really go back all the way to the mid-19th century, which we do on this map, to Herman Melville having dinner with Jesse Benton Fremont and Thomas Starr King, you know, just before the Civil War. And, you know, and that's also about that was about trying to illustrate the way that any major thoroughfare of any length is like a core sample through the city. And we talk about the Fillmore, but Fillmore Street goes through the Marina and Pacific Heights, which are definitely not hip African-American jazz districts, before it hits what we think of as the Fillmore and goes on down to, you know, the Lower Haight, where it dead ends.
Lots of emails coming in. Let's see if we can get through a number of them. This listener writes, Rebecca, do any of your maps have the theme of a cultural map or something like that? For example, I live near Lafayette Park in San Francisco, which has little-known history relating to the San Francisco Mime Troupe, whose director, R.G. Davis, got arrested there in 1965 for performing without a permit, and goes on to mention things like Bill Graham and other things. Are there references to those sorts of... Certainly reference a lot of landmark civil rights moments within the city of San Francisco.
I would say that all the maps are cultural maps. And, you know, our first map is a map of indigenous cultures. Cinema City is a map of cinematic history, Muybridge inventing cinema, Hitchcock filming Vertigo around San Francisco, and then the 70-something movie theaters that existed when Vertigo debuted in 1958. You know, that there's that Monarchs and Queens is a map of nature as butterflies, but culture as gay public spaces, mostly bars, but also some other sites like where the AIDS quilt was, where the Compton Cafeteria riot was 3 years before Stonewall. You know, the map about coffee is really about the globalization that any cup of coffee is that, you know, we seldom look at. You know, I would say it's all, I would say it's all cultural maps and cultural histories.
The coffee is a good illustration and point because we're used to seeing things that say, here's where you can get a cup of coffee or here's where you can get a burrito. But your map really brings out all these other issues. I mean, where does the coffee come from? Where does the water come from? What sort of plumbing system and water system do we need to make that cup of coffee and so forth?
Wow, you looked at that's way in the back of the book. You look careful at this one. Yeah, this was probably the map that was in my mind longest 20 years ago when before the food revolution. New Yorkers in particular always seem to be saying to me, but nature has nothing to do with me. I'm totally disconnected from nature. And I always wanted to say, the cup of coffee you're holding in your hand has water from the Adirondacks watershed, coffee from the tropics, and milk from some cow in some pastoral landscape. You're holding three landscapes just in your hand at this very moment, not counting the paper of the cup. And so I always wanted to map that. And I'm not sure how visible it is. I make it more visible in the essay. But Bob Dawson did a fantastic job of providing photographs that both give you a sense of the cafe and mapping 99 cafes in San Francisco and showing some of the systems. He's technically a landscape photographer, but even more than that, a water systems photographer and co-director with his wife, Ellen Manchester, of the Water in the West Project. So he already had photographs of the Hetch Hetchy water system. You know, people so seldom really know where they are. Not only do people not think about what's in their cup of coffee, I suspect half of San Franciscans don't know that the shower they took this morning was in snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada through the Hetch Hetchy water system. So we make some of that visible. You know, so, you know, and is that culture? I would call it all culture.
And to Kate in Berkeley. Kate, go ahead.
Hello?
Yep, Kate, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. I was just wondering if you did it. First of all, thank you for taking the call, and I love the idea of your book. I love maps. But I was wondering if you did anything with the native plants, exotic plants, that kind of thing. I know people are – well, I was amazed to discover that when they did a survey, the insects on the living roof of the new Academy of Science are all native – and the insects in the park are all exotic because, of course, the park is not native plants.
Right. Golden Gate Park is a creation. Kate, thanks for the call.
Andouins and stuff. And I was just wondering if you did something about that. I can take the answer off the air.
Thanks, Kate.
This is a very finite atlas of an infinite city. So the only specific plant mapping we have is the Monterey cypresses in Death and Beauty. But Monarchs and Queens is half about the 30-something species of butterflies here, done with the help of Liam O'Brien and of Bay Nature. And, where butterflies are indicators of what plants are there. If there's Mission Blue, there's a particular species of lupin. If there's green hair streaks, there's a particular kind of buckwheat. If there's monarchs, there's probably some overwintering eucalyptus trees or something like that for them. I believe it's is it the tiger swallowtails that feed on the plane trees all down Market Street? So there's a kind of, there's implicit plant mapping, but not explicit. You know, if you don't like the maps, go out and make some of your own.
Yeah, I think any number of people this morning are probably thinking I can add this.
A lot of the questions people get are did you think of making a bigger one? What if you map this? Would you map that? Why is North up in that conventional way? And it's clear, I think all of us want to make maps. I was just lucky enough to get to make 22 of them for this book.
Richard in Carson City just wrote in that she wishes you would now move on from the Bay Area and devote a future book to mapping the whole of the West. So there's a lot of mapping to be done.
Oh, you know, I don't know if I'll do another atlas, but I'm trying to seed one in New Orleans, and I'm talking to people all over the country about doing
this idea elsewhere,
local,
right?
Regional ones. Yeah. I'm hoping my friend Teddy Cruz does a San Diego Tijuana one. I'm talking to somebody in Albuquerque, somebody in New York. And actually, in January, I'll be the artist in residence at the University of Wyoming, and we're going to do
– In Laramie.
We're going to do an atlas of Laramie, although I'm going to leave them holding the bag because I'm not there very long.
That's a fascinating town. Susan in San Francisco is next with her question. Susan, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for this wonderful program. It seems particularly appropriate to have, this sort of celebration of memory the day after Thanksgiving and kind of thankfulness. My husband and I grew up on opposite sides of the city when there were many, many more vacant lots and sort of almost wild spaces. And all of our pets are buried on these different hillsides and different lots. So we sort of have these pet cemeteries on two sides of San Francisco. I've talked to friends who did the same thing, our goldfish and our lizards. And it's just sort of, a personal kind of map. And I just wanted to share that with you.
Susan, thanks.
Bye-bye.
See, I kind of love the way that, you know, that listeners, you are an atlas. You contain dozens of maps from the most plebeian of how you get from home to work or the grocery store to where your ancestors came from, where your most passionate moments in San Francisco were, you know, or where your goldfish is buried, for heaven's sake.
And you know, all around us. I mean, yeah, right here at KQED, which is on the corner of Mariposa and Bryant, nearby was once Best Food Mayonnaise, the Hams Brewery, Seals Stadium, where the Giants first played back in 58, a Hostess factory. I mean, it's all around.
And a lot of that is actually on our map Graveyard Shift, which maps the, you know, the defunct industrial manufacturing city, with a fantastic essay by Chris Carlson, who Diamond Dave was mentioning, who's quite helpful in various projects of this book.
We just have a moment left. So just a last thought, if you would, Rebecca Solnit, about what you hope people will get from this book, because it obviously sparks a lot of thinking from where your goldfish are to your own memories of the city.
Well, you know, one thing we didn't talk about is that there are 12 artists working on this book. The maps are full color. I think Leah Chandra designed them, the head designer at UC Press. I think they're beautiful. I'm hoping to inspire a new era of sort of progressive or radical or poetic cartography, and of making maps beautiful again, which they really kind of stopped being, these practical maps. But I'm also hoping it will make people realize how inexhaustible, how infinite a place is. The epigraph for this book comes from Henry David Thoreau, who once said, kind of tongue-in-cheek, "I have traveled widely and conquered." Concord was a little tiny town when he said that. I want people to travel widely and deeply, deeply through time and space and cultures and communities in their own place, whether it's San Francisco or Vladivostok or Shanghai or, you know, Iowa City. And this, I think, is a guide not just to this particular place, but hopefully an instigation to think about places in a wide open way.
Rebecca Solnit, again, the book is Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. She will be at San Francisco MoMA on Thursday, December the 9th at 7 o'clock, and also Saturday, December the 11th at 3 p.m. and at City Lights Bookstore this coming
Thursday, the 2nd at 7 p.m. with Aaron Shuren.
Rebecca Solnit, pleasure to have you on our program this morning. Thank you.
My pleasure, too.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.